new opportunities and challenges. If you don't push beyond your limits, you will always stay within your comfort zone and never improve or learn new things. The key difference between a boring, unsatisfying life and one of excitement, success, and growth is how willing you are to escape your comfort zone. Pushing past your comfort zone helps with success. Remember, failure is just a stepping stone to success. You will find out what works and what doesn't. As Steve Bloom says, the only thing stopping you from reaching your goals and dreams are your limits. Go beyond your perceived limits. This can open up new doors for you and help you become mentally stronger. Unfortunately, most of us have limiting beliefs which influence our performance. By pushing beyond those limits, we can influence our choices and actions, enabling us to grow and evolve. Adopting a mindset that says we can surpass the limits we've set for ourselves will help us improve. Are you willing to escape your comfort zone, that place where you are content to be? If you can push beyond the contentment and strive for something more, you will eventually feel the excitement and success of growth. This will ultimately take you to a completely new dimension, one you didn't even know existed. Arthur Clarke said, "The only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little way past them into the impossible." If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, take the time to consider your words. Where are your 7,000 going? When you notice a negative turn, either internally, in a mixed company, or directed towards someone else, remember that only you can course correct and get back on track. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on.
KBOO, Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Whether you're a man, sometimes you got to take a stand, just because you think you can.
morning. Good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'd like to welcome you to American Standoff. And as I always say at the top of the show, that this is a show that addresses or examines the current political divide going on today in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And we are continuing our coverage, and I normally I go through and look at sort of what's happening with the latest right-wing American armed insurrectionist sort of news point that's going on, and the way in which democracy, small d democracy that we have here in the United States, is being threatened. But this time, as I mentioned every show, that this show started on the anniversary of January 6th, 2021, when thousands of supporters of former President Trump stormed the Capitol, denying that Biden had been elected, claiming the election had been stolen. And we've seen the same level, we've seen quite a bit of armed insurrectionism here in the United States. I address that in my book, Standoff, looking at the Bundy takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. And of course, we also had our own Capitol breached by armed folks defying COVID restrictions. But today on American Standoff, we are going to look at Putin's nuclear threat and MAD, the mutually assured destruction, part of a military concept from the Cold War, and its roots in the colonial origin story. So I often talk about the colonial origin story and contrast that with the indigenous origin story and of a people. Like, what are the defining factors that people have about themselves and the relationship to the earth? And so I do see the idea of nuclear and actually the turning to nuclear power to solve the carbon emission issue and fight climate change being very concerning. In fact, my next book is a book of essays called Letters to Oppenheimer from the Fourth World, in which I address this legacy created by the splitting of the first of the atomic bomb of the atoms for the atom in New Mexico in Trinity Site. So we're going to go a bit into that history a little bit and sort of how that contrasts with sort of native ideas of the land, right? So in this episode, we're looking at Putin's nuclear threat sort of in this context, right, which is a different context than you probably hear anyone else discuss anywhere, really. So he is claiming that that the West is using the threat of nuclear weapons to blackmail Russia. And he made a startling announcement that those who try to blackmail us with nuclear weapons should know that the weather vane can turn and point towards them. Right, which is pretty scary sounding. And Putin also said Russia would give its full support to the referendums announced for this weekend in Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia to join the Russian Federation. The last part being where there is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, and that is presently being monitored by UN UN officials, and does have the threat of a catastrophic sort of event happening there that could spread in a sort of Chernobyl kind of way, nuclear radiation across the continent of Europe, and possibly as happened in Chernobyl, the winds carry it all over the place. But let's open actually with Biden's remarks yesterday regarding Putin's threats.
In a brutal, needless war, a war chosen by one man, to be very blunt. Let us speak plainly. A permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase the sovereign state from the map. Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. No more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force. Again, just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe. and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime. Now, Russia's calling team. Now, Russia's calling up more soldiers to join the fight. And the Kremlin is organizing a sham referendum to try to annex parts of Ukraine, an extremely significant violation of the UN Charter. This world should see these outrageous acts for what they are. Putin claims he had to act because Russia was threatened. But no one threatened Russia. And no one other than Russia sought conflict. But this past year, the world was tested as well. But we did not hesitate. We chose liberty. We chose sovereignty. We chose principles to which every party to the United Nations Charter is beholden. Let me also urge every nation to recommit to strengthening the nuclear non-proliferation regime through diplomacy. No matter what else is happening in the world, the United States is ready to pursue critical arms control measures. A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. Five permanent members of the Security Council just reaffirmed that commitment in January. But today, we're seeing disturbing trends. Russia shunned the non-proliferation ideals embraced by every other nation at the 10th NPT review conference. And again, today, as I said, they're making irresponsible nuclear threats to use nuclear weapons. China's conducting an unprecedented concerning nuclear buildup without any transparency. Despite our efforts to begin serious and sustained diplomacy, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea continues to blatantly violate U.S. sanctions. While the United States is prepared for a mutual return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action if Iran steps up to its obligations, the United States is clear. We will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. I continue to believe that diplomacy is the best way to achieve this outcome. The non-proliferation regime is one of the greatest successes of this institution. We cannot let the world now slide backwards.
So that was Biden speaking yesterday before the UN General Assembly. And I just focused on the parts of his speech that focused on the issue of nuclear proliferation, the threats that Russia is making regarding the use of nuclear weapons and other states as well. And just some background disclosure about myself. My family has had a lot of, as a Native family, has a lot of intersections with the nuclear industry, starting with uranium mining. Part of the reason I'm writing the book is because of that. As I mentioned before on the show, my grandparents were traditional Navajos who lived on the reservation in Arizona. My mother's family ran a ranch near the south rim of the Grand Canyon in Cameron, Arizona. And there's a lot of abandoned uranium mines around Cameron. And that was a place where they did a lot of uranium mining. And in fact, my grandfather, he was a uranium miner. And in fact, what I discovered doing research on these abandoned uranium mines, when I was married out there in a traditional Navajo ceremony to honor my elders. As I mentioned, most of that generation, my mother's parents' generation and her aunts and uncles, didn't speak English. They were traditional Navajos. They didn't really, they were traditional Navajo was their primary culture, right? And so they didn't really understand Christianity. They were Navajo. They were Diné, right, as we call ourselves, the people. I'd grown up seeing my grandparents attending weddings by some of my aunts and uncles that were like European Christian weddings, and I saw them so sort of not able to participate because they couldn't speak English, right? And they were dressed traditionally. My grandmother wore her hair in a bun. She wore traditional Navajo turquoise. Both my grandparents did wore traditional Navajo jewelry, and my grandmother wore the skirts, the Navajo, velvet tops, and my grandfather, dressed like a cowboy, but with Navajo jewelry, and you know, his ears were pierced and everything. So these were traditional Navajos. Like, they don't know anything. They're not like typical Americans, right? And so I really felt like I wanted to honor them and give them a place and in this important moment in my own life. And so I chose to have a Navajo wedding and have it on the reservation and have it, you know, there on my mother's family's land. And they built this wonderful traditional hogan for us. It's really large hogan, and they had a big, you know, people came. Just, you think there's no one there in the desert, but just people came from everywhere to attend, and it was just this amazing event, and something I'm really, really glad I did, because, you know, that generation is dying off now, but then I found out later, just recently, in fact, I found out that there was. I think I was there out there in 2017 doing a book reading in Flagstaff, and I drove up there with a friend, Cree Benali, who's a Navajo activist and musician, and we did some radiation sort of measurements, Geiger counter measurements, and you can see some of the photos on my Flickr account, and you know, and there is an abandoned uranium mine right near my grandparents' house. I just never realized it until they fenced it off and put signs up just a few years before that. And then right where where we have our ceremonies further out in the desert, that's where we were married, and we have our family reunions out there too. And we have a traditional hogan, you know, where we can do ceremonies and things like that. And that's where I was married, and I didn't realize there were abandoned uranium mines just next to them, like right. I mean, we're not talking far away, we're talking like right next to them. And so it's just all around the community. Like, I think official estimates of 100, some say maybe 200 abandoned uranium mines around Cameron itself, and there are about 500 around the Navajo Nation. Some people double those estimates because they think that there is more than one in each area, but that's just the official count, right? And so the Navajo Nation, as I mentioned before, is the size of Ireland. And so, you know, this level of these sort of radioactive spa hot spots all around where people live, it really limits the ability for Navajo people to grow. I mean, the Navajo population has increased a lot since my grandparents' generation. I think when they were growing up in the 30s, there were like 35,000 Navajos. Now there's 400,000. So we, you know, to have people live on the reservation, we need to ensure their safety. And many Navajo people have been the victims of radiation exposure and died terrible deaths. And we've lost so many traditional elders and just the future of our country and of our nation. And so, you know, we went out there and did some Geiger counter readings to see how hot they were. And while we were there, I saw my uncle still lived there right by one of the abandoned uranium mines, and some of the water, the rainwater, was trickling out from the mine and trickling right into his garden, and it was so sad. And we had to tell him that. And then the next time I came back, he had stopped gardening there. You know, it's just, you know, it's just really, really hard to make a life in a place where the U.S. America's nuclear a program has basically made it very difficult for Diné people to do so safely, right? And so part of my letters to Oppenheimer is to basically address his role in this. And so I've been doing a lot of research on his life and his perspective to understand how he brought this to our people in the Southwest, because this not only impacts the Navajo Nation, but other culturally intact Native communities. I mean, I'm sort of surprised most people don't realize that tribes in the Southwest, particularly the Navajo, the Hopi, the Pueblos, the Zuni, they are traditional communities that have retained their language and are mostly full bloods. I mean, it's just like, if you meet a Hopi person who looks white, it's very unusual. They're a unicorn, okay? And so most Native people there in the Southwest, in the Four Corners area, have retained their cultures. They still speak their languages, all of these things, but they are endangered by this nuclear poison pill that's been introduced into their communities. And so this is part about it. And of course, you know, Los Alamos is located up there in the mountains in New Mexico, north of Santa Fe, which is near a Pueblo there as well. A lot of Pueblo people worked as part of the Manhattan Project. which was the project, the federal project to build the atomic bomb. And so Los Alamos was where the scientists were located, like Oppenheimer. Richland, Washington, where I grew up, is the site of the Hanford Nuclear, they call it a reservation, or they also call it a site, but that's where plutonium was first refined or at a kind of an industrial level, which was required for the bombs. And we'll go into a bit more on that. And then Oak Ridge, Tennessee, is where the uranium was refined. And so they built two bombs, three bombs. So there was enough plutonium for two of the bombs, and there was enough uranium for one bomb. And so the first test bomb was the one done at Trinity Site in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And that was a plutonium bomb from plutonium from Hanford in Washington State, just upriver from us. And so that was the very, and that's the one where Oppenheimer famously is quoted as saying, you know, I am the creator and destroyer of worlds, you know, and all these things, and sort of this from, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, quoting Krishna. And it's to me, from my Diné perspective, from my Navajo perspective, what my mother taught me, right? And my mother, you know, her first language is Navajo. She was raised by traditional parents. And what, you know, I look at that, and part of what I see is the creation of a new world, right? So when I say letters to Oppenheimer from the fourth world was the world in which the Diné people emerged, and the area around the Four Corners area is where we emerged from the previous world, from the third world, right? And when we emerged, right, we were greeted by the holy people, right? And the holy people came, and we call this the glittering world, the fourth world, the glittering world, because it was covered in water, and the light was glinting off, you know, the waves. And so the holy people came, and they pushed the water back, and we emerged, and we were gifted with the songs. My grandfather was a very respected singer, and in Navajo, our medicine men are singers. Like you'll meet a lot of Navajos with the last name Singer, right? And that's because their ancestor was a medicine man, a Hatatli, right? And so our ceremonies that we do in our hogans are, you know, they include sand paintings, which many of you may be familiar with, and then and these depict healing stories, sacred stories from our traditional stories, and then, you know, the patient is set on the sand painting, and then they're sung over sometimes for 9 days and nights. So my grandfather was always corralled to be a singer at these things. He was not a medicine man. He was a hand trembler. He could tell you what's wrong with you and which medicine man to go to or healer. But when I see that, I see what the scientists did. I sort of see that as akin to what Coyote did, right? So the reason why we were fleeing the third world was because it was being flooded by water, by the water monster, right? And so first man, he planted a seed, and it grew into a reed, and people and other and animals have climbed through there and escaped and came here to this fourth world. And then Coyote came as well. And then the water started bubbling up through the reed, right? This is all very much birth imagery. I'll be catching that. But the water's still bubbling up through the reed and threatening to flood this world as well. And so they look and they suddenly notice that Coyote is carrying the water monster's baby, right? And this is why she was so angry and why she was flooding the previous world. So they made him return the baby, and then the water stopped coming up through the reed. And so in a way, I see what the scientists did at Alamogordo at Trinity Site was that they were like the coyote stealing the water babies, the water monster's baby, right? And at that point, they did that when they split the atom and created the first atomic bomb and the first mushroom cloud seen on this earth, right, that we know of. But at that point, we entered another world. We entered the fifth world. This is the atomic age. And this is just my perspective as someone who's grown up around the, impacts of the Manhattan Project, right? And so at this point that we are in a different world, that we need songs to keep us in harmony and hojo with everything around us. We need new songs. We need new medicine, you know, whether it's, you know, corn, the thought. We need all these things that need to be brought to us, right, and given to us so that we can be in harmony. But now the creation story is not like the one where, you know, people are being punished, right? They're being rejected by the presence, from the presence of God for sinning. No, we're here and we're being taken care of, and we are here to live in harmony, right? It's very different. It's one, again, one of those origin story concepts that lead to outcomes, right? I always talk about that, how origin stories are like if-then statements, right? Algorithms, and then lead to consequences. When a people's concept of who they are, of how they relate to the earth, how they relate to everything around them, what their prescriptions are, whether it's to make a profit, as the colonial people have, or to respect the earth and to follow the rules that you made in agreement with the earth itself, right? With our mother and our father. You know, Navajos often say that, you know, I'm never alone because I'm in, you know, my mother, I'm in the hands of my mother, and I look up and there's the sky, my father, right? And so different concept of how you relate to the world and your place in it and your place as a people, right? And so I see what the atomic scientists did as being, you know, a kind of a manifestation of that, of what Coyote did. And so my letters are a way of sort of addressing that, you know, and speaking back to that as a Diné woman, as a Diné and Dakota woman, right? Because there is also uranium mining that's been going on in the Dakotas as well, particularly around the Black Hills, which are sacred to my father's people. And so a lot of this is looking at that and trying to understand what that's about. So that's sort of the framework for what I'm discussing. And actually, okay, we're getting pretty late here. So let me go ahead, and I've also wanted to play some coverage by CNN on Putin's remarks.
Dramatic escalation of Russia's war in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin announces a mobilization, calling up an additional 300,000 troops. I'm John Berman with Erica Hill this morning, and this is the biggest move by Russia since it invaded Ukraine in February. Putin announced a partial mobilization to begin immediately. Now, Britain's defense secretary says this is an admission that Russia's invasion is failing. Russia has suffered humiliating losses with troops retreating from occupied territory. The Putin speech was riddled with false claims and contained ominous nuclear language, with Putin promising to defend his country.
This is not a bluff. The citizens of Russia can be sure that the territorial integrity of our homeland, our independence, and freedom will be ensured. And those who try to blackmail us with nuclear weapons should know that the prevailing winds can turn in their direction.
That was some of that was the very ominous sort of statements being made by Putin. That's what got me thinking about this topic, and I really wanted to kind of lay a different groundwork for understanding why I feel like, you know, that we don't often talk about the continued threat of nuclear holocaust, right? And I know I don't cover the most the happiest topics on this show, I admit that, but you know, I think that one of the things I wanted to bring into this topic was also the issue of, in addition to what Putin is doing in Ukraine, is I wanted to bring this back to the Pacific Northwest, to the place that we live, right? And part of the issue for me is Hanford, not just because I grew up there. My dad was an engineer there, full disclosure. But also, you know, because it's something that we don't talk about enough in Portland, Oregon, the Hanford Nuclear Reservation just north of us, and upriver from us, right? And I think that it's something that we need to focus much more concretely on as a community. And in that spirit, I want to share some audio to give people background about Hanford. And why is Hanford, maybe I should answer this question first. Why is Hanford relevant? Why is Hanford relevant to what's happening internationally with the threat of use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine, or by Russia, or, you know, even the threat to the Zaporizhia power plant, the nuclear power plant in Ukraine. And why does that, what does that have to do with our area, right? And you know, we are no longer, I mean, I remember growing up and hearing that, Richland, Washington was one of the top targets in the case of a nuclear war by the then Soviet Union, right? And that is pretty scary because of the level of contamination. It's considered the most contaminated area in the Western Hemisphere, and of course, there has been cleanup going on. And I thought I'd give you guys some background to it. So this is a bit long, but I think it's really important. I might cut it off a little early.
Gallons of contaminated groundwater.
Sorry about that. Let me get back to the beginning. There we go.
A lot of the people come here with a lot of questions. A lot of people come here with some concerns.
The one word I would use to describe Hanford would be change.
Massive.
Enormous.
Employment.
I suppose it's cleanup.
Controversial.
Toxic.
Taxes. Technology.
Bureaucracy.
Nuclear weapons production.
As I think of testing.
Energy.
Science. Jobs. Unsustainable.
Money pit.
Historic.
Chaotic.
Radioactivity. Impossible.
Unbelievable.
Unsafe. Complicated.
Maybe the best word is complex. Welcome to Hanford. It's here. In this seemingly nondescript desert of southeastern Washington state, that you will find one of our nation's most compelling stories. The Hanford most people are familiar with was born out of an intense race to produce the world's first atomic bomb during the Second World War. Before there was a Hanford, these windblown plains served Native American tribes such as the Wampum, Yakima, Umatilla, and Nez Perce, who hunted, fished, and gathered traditional foods and medicines along the banks of the Columbia River. The U.S. War Department handpicked Hanford for its plutonium production needs as part of the Manhattan Project. The recently constructed Grand Coulee Dam offered the electricity and infrastructure necessary to operate the reactors. The area was remote and sparsely populated, and the Columbia River offered a plentiful source of cold water, also necessary for the operation of the nuclear reactors and the plutonium they yielded. Hanford construction effort began in earnest in 1943. Drawing tens of thousands of workers from across the U.S. Hundreds of facilities and buildings, along with their supporting infrastructure, were constructed across the 586 square mile site, an area that would easily fit the city of Los Angeles today. Hanford employed some 50,000 people, ranging from laborers and security personnel to scientists and engineers. One of the world's greatest construction projects of that era, Hanford's B reactor, is perhaps the site's most iconic image. The world's first full-scale production nuclear reactor. This ambitious engineering feat went from design to startup in just 13 months, under a high degree of secrecy, with minimal blueprints, drawings, or designs developed for reference by workers.
Well, I was directed to the administration building, which is located about where the federal building is now. And I was signed in, and I was instructed to go to the 300 area to begin with. I had no idea what I was here for. And I came strictly for several personal reasons and for the money.
The race to produce the world's first atomic bomb was running at a fevered pitch. While small amounts of plutonium had been produced at facilities in Chicago, nothing of this magnitude or complexity had ever been attempted. Producing plutonium was complex and messy, with the added potential of being catastrophically lethal. The process started with uranium billets that were fabricated into nuclear fuel rods in the 300 area and transported via rail to the 100 area, where they were inserted into one of multiple process tubes in the 30-foot-high reactor core. With water from the Columbia River rushing into the reactor, a nuclear chain reaction transformed uranium into plutonium.
It's hard for people to imagine the enormous energy that's produced in the reactor, but as I remember, the flow at that time was like 186,000 gallons a minute, and that water is entering the front face in cold, ice cold, and it's exiting the rear face at nearly boiling temperatures in that short distance of time. And there's 2004 process tubes is going through there. So it's hard to imagine the energy that is contained unless you hear, you see it, you feel it. It's just massive amount of energy that you experience. But the startup is a startup like that is phenomenal.
After a short cooling off period, the now highly irradiated fuel rods were transported to T-Plant in Hanford's 200 area. T-Plant was one of several enormous facilities, the size of ocean liners. In fact, they were frequently referred to as Queen Marys by Hanford workers. It was here they separated plutonium from irradiated fuel rods, using a complex and massive liquid chemical bath process. T-Plant was the first facility of its kind in the world. Like the world's most elaborate and intricate gold panning operation, the process yielded minute amounts of plutonium. By weight, the most expensive material on the planet. The extracted plutonium was processed into buttons. Buttons that would serve as the core of the atomic bomb. Billions of gallons of highly radioactive liquid waste, a byproduct of this chemical separation process, were stored in roughly 60 underground tanks, ranging from 500,000 to 1,000,000 gallons in capacity. Ultimately, the Manhattan Project was a success, and the long-kept secret was out. The plutonium produced at Hanford was used in the Fat Man bomb dropped on Nagasaki on August 9, 1945, forcing Japan's surrender and bringing an end to the war. Ushering in the atomic age, Hanford continued to support America's peace through strength policies throughout the Cold War, producing enough plutonium to maintain a continual and formidable deterrent to any potentially hostile nation, namely the Soviet Union. However, during these critical wartime and national security missions, the thought of what to do with the resulting waste and what its impact on the environment might be was secondary to the need for immediate production and use of the vital plutonium. Nearly 200 million gallons of this waste was held in underground storage tanks, or worse, returned directly to the ground. The sheer magnitude of the impact on the environment is staggering, resulting in nearly incomprehensible numbers. Numbers like 270 billion gallons of contaminated groundwater, 25 million cubic feet of buried or stored solid waste, 2,300 tons of spent nuclear fuel, 20 tons of plutonium-bearing materials, and 53 million gallons of waste in 177 underground storage tanks. This waste is the legacy of more than five decades of plutonium production, making it easy to see how Hanford became the largest, most complex environmental cleanup effort in the world. Over the past 20 years, incredible progress has been made, resulting in the successful treatment of 4.4 billion gallons of contaminated groundwater, movement of all spent nuclear fuel to dry storage, shipment of all plutonium special nuclear materials designated for off-site storage out of Washington State, and the removal of all pumpable liquids from 149 single-shelled underground storage tanks.
That's rather very long clip from a video that you can find on online on YouTube, actually, that goes through a lot of the Hanford site. I think that we don't, here in Portland, we don't think about it enough. And you know, of course, this is a highly contaminated area. You know, the there was recent reporting about how the GOA actually wants to reduce the skyrocketing costs of treating the Hanford site's 56 million gallons of radioactive and hazardous chemical tank waste. This is the Government Accountability Office. This was in August. And so it's just really, in 2000, when they started building the project, they've been planning it much longer, the estimated cost to complete the construction was $4.3 billion. But at the start of the summer, the Department of Energy said it has spent $13 billion with no waste yet treated at the plant. So it's, the Army Corps of Engineers estimated in 2018 that completing the vitrification plant, which is I'm going to get into a little bit of description on, and actually, full disclosure, my father did work on the engineering on the vitrification plant, which is to turn this plutonium byproduct waste into glass to vitrify it, so that it's not it makes it inert, so it's not movable, right? And so the Army Corps of Engineers estimated in 2018 that completing the vitrification plant or waste treatment plant would cost $33 billion to $42 billion. This is all money being spent, federal dollars being spent, just about a four-hour drive from us up the Columbia Gorge, right? And so when someone said it's about money, right? And it definitely is, you know, and about radioactivity. So the vitrification plant will be treating designed to separate the millions of gallons of waste stored in underground tanks into low activity and high level radioactive waste for glassification, right? It sounds really good, right? But there are some concerns. So let me play a little bit about that.
Hanford's cleanup plans might someday include a process called vitrification, in which tank wastes are immobilized by turning them into a solid glass-like substance that can be stored in stainless steel containers. In this glass-like form, the waste is impervious to the environment, and its radioactivity can safely dissipate over hundreds to thousands of years. Bechtel National Incorporated was hired to design and build the Hanford Tank Waste Treatment and Immobilization Plant, also known as the VIT plant. The construction, which began in 2002, is scheduled for completion in 2023 and has a budget of $17 billion. The U.S. Department of Energy, or DOE, hopes to solidify the 56 million gallons of liquid radioactive waste now held in 177 underground storage tanks. Since each tank has a different combination of radioactive and toxic substances, vitrifying Hanford's waste poses many challenges, as Gary Peterson will explain. Followed by John Fox and Tom Carpenter.
The liquid waste at Hanford is unlike any other site. It's not like Savannah River. It's not like Oak Ridge. They tried different processes to speed up the production of plutonium. And so they had a variety of different ways that they would remove the plutonium chemically. And so no two tanks are alike. And there's 177 tanks. And no two tanks are alike in the composition within those tanks. And so it becomes a very complex problem. So the 177 tanks out there have all different chemicals in those tanks. So as you get to the tanks and you want to solidify it, turn it into glass, you have to have a plant that can take any composition of a material and mix it and do it safely in zones that you may never be able to go back into. And so it has to be almost 100% fail-safe before you start. And so that's why the waste treatment plant is taking so long. That's why it costs so much.
All of that means we've got a much more complicated situation to face, and it's exacerbated by adoption early on of this so-called black cell design for the VIT plant, which was adapted from a British approach, which says you build this thing so you don't require any pumping and mixing and things that require maintenance. Everything's driven by test pumps pressurized by hydraulic or pneumatic pressure to move things around. So you don't ever need to go into the plant to maintain it. Well, you can never answer all the reliability questions that get raised.
I'm pretty pessimistic about the approach they've taken and how they've painted themselves into a corner with the waste treatment plant. You know, one of the design issues was in the 90s, the Department of Energy hired the British to design our waste treatment plant. And they used something called black cell design. Black cell is called that because they take all these nuclear processes that are supposed to separate nuclear waste in a huge room, the size of a football field or two football fields and as high, just loaded with tanks and pipes and equipment. And once you seal it off and start it up, you don't have lights in there. You don't have entries into there. You can't get in to inspect, to repair, to replace equipment that's failed. It's supposed to operate for 45 years with no inspection, no repair, and no replacement. So if something breaks anytime in there, a pipe breaks, it contaminates the whole facility, and now have this huge, highly radioactive facility, well, what's that going to cost to clean up? Nobody knows, right? And the facility's useless. If not worse, it may be a safety threat as well.
Hanford's current plan for handling tank waste is based on British success. However, Hanford's task is more complicated because of the variety of radioactive and toxic mixtures in its 177 tanks. Four major nuclear facilities and 20 supporting facilities are now being designed. If all goes well, the process will begin by 2023 and take about 40 years to complete.
So, as you hear, this plant was scheduled to go online in 2023, although with there was a recent sort of pushing back that deadline to 2025, although the DOE says that they still are focusing on getting ready by the end of 2023 to begin processing waste. And so this is all 4-hour drive from us going on. Once again, I like to remind people this is a call-in show. I have failed to do that this hour. The studio phone is 503-231-8187. Please call in if you have anything, any comments on Putin's nuclear threat and sort of how the threat of the atomic age still has over all of us today. And one of the reasons I bring this up is because, this black box situation is very troubling, because if it were to anything to happen, even the piping, my father worked on the piping in this project, he said that the plutonium waste is kind of sludgy and it can stop. If it does stop, it can actually start its own nuclear chain reaction. and so it's actually very, very dangerous. We don't know what's going to happen when they start up. It could be quite dangerous, and it could actually make, if things were to go very badly, it would not only impact the Hanford site, the 600 square mile site, but it would also impact the region. It would have a regional impact, and depending on which way the wind blows, Hanford famously has the downwinder situation where they did a green run test, I think in 1948, they're basically doing experimentation on the population, so it's really troubling, and the handling of Bechtel as the principal contractor on this has also raised a lot of question marks. And there's this continued danger as well. I was looking at, there are a lot of really great books about the issue of Hanford and of plutonium power. I would really recommend reading. One is a great book called Plutopia, which really goes into it's a book called Plutopia, Nuclear Families, Atomic Cities, and the Great Soviet and American Plutonium Disasters, which compares, it's written by environmental historian Kate Brown. It compares the cities of Richland, Washington, here in the Pacific Northwest, which is adjacent to the U.S. Department of Energy's Hanford site, the plutonium production area, and Ozersk, Russia's southern Ural mountain region, which was a very similar city. And I definitely recommend reading that book. It's really an extraordinary record of what went into that. But another book, an excerpt of which you can find in the Atlantic magazine, is the article is titled "The 60-Year Downfall of Nuclear Power in the U.S. Has Left a Huge Mess," right? It's an excerpt from a book called Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age by Fred Pierce. And let me just read you a little bit of this excerpt. It was just another day in the life of a defunct Hanford nuclear site, a remote part of Washington state that made most of the plutonium in America's Cold War arsenal. On the morning of May 9th, 2017, this is about 5 years ago, over 5 years ago, alarms sounded. Around 2,000 site workers were told to take cover indoors, and aircraft was banned from flying over the site for several hours. The roof of a tunnel had collapsed, exposing rail cars that had been loaded with radioactive waste from plutonium production and then shunted underground and sealed in decades before. There was other stuff down there, too. Nobody quite knew what. Record keeping was poor, but the contents of the tunnels certainly included carcasses from animal radiation experiments, including a reported 18 alligators. The emergency lasted only a few hours. The integrity of the waste was restored, but it was a chilling reminder of the site's perilous radioactive legacy. Sprawling over 600 square miles in semi-brush, semi-desert, Hanford is a $100 billion cleanup burden, full of accidents waiting to happen. It is the biggest headache by far, but very far from being the only one emerging in what is increasingly looking. Well, when this article was written in 2018, it was excerpt published in 2018, it was looking like the final years of America's nuclear age. Of course, now that is changing. Part of the plan to fight climate change includes restarting nuclear reactors. I think recently, what is that site called in California, it was supposed to be shut down in 2025, but has since been, maybe extended. That was from Governor Newsom. And of course we don't know where we're going to put the waste. I think some of the workers have been experiencing effects from exposure to this day. In fact, Senator Patty Murray is right now pushing to obtain for them more immediate care, right? Medical care. And so that is happening right now as we speak. Of course, they pay Hanford workers very well. So people are willing to put themselves at risk, right? The government has an obligation to protect the population, and it does not have a great track record in that regard. I was going to play some audio, which is really, I really do recommend looking it up on YouTube, which is called, it's from Atomic Veterans. These were soldiers that were used during the test, the bombing tests that were conducted throughout the 50s and I think into the 60s, and the way in which they were exposed to nuclear radiation and these things. And were basically, they really had no purpose being in the blast zone, but apparently they were just being used as guinea pigs, right? And also there's another really very difficult one to watch, which concerns British, I think it's on Vice News, they have one interviewing British men who were also were in the services at the time, and were about 20,000 of them were similarly used as guinea pigs. And many of them cannot have children, were not able to have children, and or if they did have children, their children experienced a lot of, they have a lot of diseases and illnesses from the radiation exposure that their fathers had. And So with the Green Run, all the stuff, the U.S. does not have, our government does not have a great track record, or even exposure in the Southwest from many different communities, including my own family. My mother has family members who have died of cancer and have qualified, actually, as downwinders. The area around Cameron is the Painted Desert. It's dusty. The uranium gets airborne and people breathe it in. My grandfather, who was a uranium miner, and if you look at the maps of the abandoned uranium mines around Cameron, you will see they named them after local Navajos. The uranium companies did. One of them is named after my grandfather, Elwood Canyon. Another is named after my great-grandfather, John Canyon, and another great-grandfather, Juan Horson, Juan Big Horse. And my mother's uncle, Jefferson Canyon, as well. And it seems almost cynical, Janine. They did not warn Navajo uranium workers about the dangers. They were working without any protection. When I was doing research on this book, I found that uranium miners, at the time, the U.S. was buying uranium at artificially high rates, like $30 to $50 a ton. This was in the 1940s, 1950s. And they found that one of the government help people found out that if they just spent a few pennies per ton, like, they could protect the Navajo workers, you know, by wetting down the area, doing very minimal things. They could protect them from exposure, and they chose not to. They want not even spend, you know, I think it was less than 10 cents a pound, a ton, to protect Navajo workers. And so some members of my mother's family have qualified for this. Many Navajos have a very difficult time getting any sort of response, you know, from the suffering they've endured. And, you know, we talk about valuing indigenous cultures. We talk about saving indigenous languages. And yet you have here the Navajo Nation, which was culturally intact, even, you know, into when I was growing up. I mean, it's just, and yet our people were seen as utterly disposable. And of course, many of these uranium miners, Navajo uranium miners, could not speak English and were not educated and were unable to really understand or advocate for themselves. In fact, an interesting thing to note is that the name for uranium in Navajo is called yellow dirt, right? And it's often in a lot of these interviews done with traditional Navajos, you'll see them making a comparison to uranium, the yellow dirt, and how it looks like pollen, right? In our traditional way, in the Dene way, the pollen path, that's the way of beauty, you know, the way of living in the world in a way that's in balance and harmony. This is a big focus of Navajo culture, not profitability, not all this stuff that is sort of the focus of colonial culture, the driving forces of colonial culture. And so, you know, one of the big uranium mines was around near Monument Valley. There they did actual tunneling. And for a long time, they were the Navajos, the traditional Navajos knew that the Americans were looking for this uranium, but they didn't want to tell them about it. They knew they kind of what they were looking for, but and they knew the land really well, of course, because Navajos are sheep herders and ranchers, so they're always on their land and you know, on horseback, but they didn't want to tell them. And finally one of them did, and he thought, well, maybe I can get some money from this. And he shared, and in different parts of the Navajo Nation, people have different traditional stories. They vary a little bit from region to region. You know, my family's in Cameron, which is the very southwestern part of the Navajo Nation. Monument Valley is more of the northwestern central part of the Navajo Nation. And they're very different areas. Some of the traditions and cultural stories are slightly different, and even the dialects are a little different. But the they have stories about how, you know, in the beginning, like I mentioned, when we emerged from the third world, we were given a choice between choosing uranium and pollen, right? And that we chose the pollen path. And when we did this, the holy people said to us that we had chosen the right path, right? And then, but what is defined by? It's this choice of the path of uranium. Right. And I think sometimes about, you know, the nature of basically, you know, taking apart reality at the atomic level, right? And what that means and what that means about our relationship to the integrity of the earth, of our mother, right? Of her being and all that. And so I often feel like, you know, this is part of how I'm viewing what's happening at the international scale. You know, when you're looking at the brutality of war, of the venality of autocratic leaders, right? And you contrast that, you know, with our own traditional Diné social structures, which we didn't even have a leader, you know, until we had to fight the Americans. We were, I was mentioning my friend Cleve Benali, and you know, he's a Navajo anarchist, he believes. and not anarchy in the European sense, but anarchy in the way that the Diné people lived it. You know, we weren't ruled by a government. People were ruled by this concept of hojo, of harmony, right? And this was the ruling principle in our communities, not autocracy, not threats from a powerful ruling class. It was people, each Navajo family lived their lives with their focus being this pollen path, this harmony, maintaining it, everything they did, right? Maintaining these ceremonies. And it's such a different way of living. And I often, you know, look at my traditional grandparents and great aunts and uncles, and I felt like they were I don't know, there was a nobility to their life that I don't really see in just the sort of crass capitalistic lives that we're expected to live here. Like if I were to contrast them to other white people that came of age in the 1930s, you know, and 40s, you know, my grandparents, I just feel like I just have so much respect for them and for the dignity in which they lived their lives and the beauty that they maintained in their culture. You know, my grandmother was a rug weaver, you know, I mean, even traveling on horseback as a kid across our ranch, going through the painted desert, my aunt and my uncle's wife, they were doing sand paintings for tourists. They were selling, putting them on boards and gluing them up the sand on boards and doing these traditional designs and selling them to make money. And we would go through the painted desert and collect the sand. And my aunt would tell me sort of like what each of these areas meant and what, because each of these things like have some sort of attribute in our tradition, right? And so it was, as a child, it was like it was a big learning process to go home, you know, every summer and see everyone and suddenly be living a different kind of life. And I think it definitely shaped me as a person. And I wish everyone had that opportunity, you know. But of course, things like this, the uranium industry, the atomic age, American imperialism has really made that very difficult, and the survival of our culture very difficult. So anyway, we're coming to the end of our hour here. I'd really like to thank you all. I would love to have a conversation about this with folks and what they think about Hanford in particular, because it's such a, I mean, if they do start it at the end of 2023, you know, we're going to have to be addressing that in a far more real way, because we don't know what's going to happen. So thank you so much. Ahiha and Hagona. Oh,